Please rise. And we have three commissioners to confirm, if that's the desire of the committee. We've got other appointments and another commissioner, I believe, scheduled for next week. Didn't know how long these would take, so we're not doing them all today. But anyway, with that, Mr. Fields from Blandon, would you wish to, why don't you proceed and identify yourself for the tape and...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and give you an update on our initiative. My name is Gary Fields. I'm the project consultant to the Blandon Foundation on their broadband initiative. My background is not in broadband and telecommunications. It's actually in economic development. I've probably been involved in this industry for about 25 years. My most recent engagement with the state is I was deputy commissioner at DTED for about 5 years, and when I left there about 4 years ago, I started a consulting practice working with foundations that invest in economic development and housing. And I had the fortune to talk to the Blandon Foundation about what was happening in rural communities, and we realized that that the use and deployment of broadband-based technologies was an absolutely essential part of the shift in the economies in our rural communities from a natural resource economy to a knowledge economy. And this was actually a critical piece of that. So we started this broadband initiative about 4 years ago. Our approach, I think, probably, I suspect many of you are familiar with the Blandon Foundation. We really have three major components of the foundation. Leadership development is probably the one we're known by the best. We've trained thousands of Minnesota leaders in across the state. We've got a large grant-making operation that probably spends about $20 million a year. We're Minnesota's largest rural philanthropy. And we have a public policy and engagement initiative, and this is one of the initiatives in that. We have one in forest products as well. And so this is comes out of our public policy work. We started this initiative about 4 years ago. We're guided by an 18-person strategy board. It includes the CEOs of half a dozen internet service providers, state legislative and administrative officials, business leaders, local officials, there's some key user groups. We have a school district superintendent and a hospital administrator. And on the inside cover of the handout, we've distributed. It shows all of the members. They've been a very vocal and vital group to our initiative. It's a great batch of leaders that have guided us in our efforts. Our simple goals: we want to increase the awareness about the need to enhance broadband. We want to increase the use of broadband, both on business-wise and residential residential use. And also, and probably just as important as the others, to start to increase the public and private investment in rural broadband. When we started this initiative, we thought that there was a digital divide between metro and rural areas. But actually, the digital divide is not a geographic divide. Actually, and I'll get into this a little more detail in a minute, but there are some rural communities that actually have much better broadband service than what is available in the metro area. The digital divide really occurs along demographic lines. Older people use broadband less, and poorer people obviously use broadband less. And if you don't have a computer in your home, you don't use broadband at all. So if there's a digital divide, it's along age and income lines. It's not along geographic lines. In the 4 years we've been operating, I think we've made some major accomplishments. We produced a community guide to broadband development. It's about a 100-page guide. It's actually targeted for people just like yourselves. So I encourage you to take a look at it. It's available on our website. It just kind of gives you the basics and some of the key issues, and also gives you some guidance about some of the things you can do both in your communities and here at the legislature. We've had three broadband policy conferences that have been very successful and had good participation. About 3 years ago, we launched the Get Broadband program. And this is a program that goes community by community, works with the businesses, the schools, the hospitals, the governments, the general population, and gets people to use the services and applications that are available to them. We know that the take rates, the subscription rates in Minnesota, are pretty low, and we know we can't increase the investment in broadband to get up to what I'll talk in a minute about as being the world-class type of service that's available until we get people using it more. So we started this program about 3 years ago, and I want to thank the Senate and the House for matching the foundation's investment in this. The foundation put $250,000 into this initiative, and the legislature matched that with $250,000 investment, and it's been successful. And I'll just speak briefly in a minute about the results. And then in 2005, we created a state broadband vision. Again, developed by our strategy board, businesses, internet service providers, residents, And I think it's a strong vision that can help guide us. How are we doing in general? Well, the U.S. is no longer a global leader in usage or infrastructure. And with all respect to Al Gore, the Internet was invented in the U.S., but if you look at how broadband is used now around the world, we are actually in the mid-teens in terms of the percentage of users. The U.S. is far from being a world leader in the use of broadband. And what I'll also talk a little bit about is our infrastructure is not as good either. Minnesota compares okay with other states, but that really doesn't matter much. Our global competitors are Northern Europe, the Pacific Rim, India, Singapore, and those are the countries we have to compete with, and right now we're not doing very well. Again, rural communities lag the metro communities, but in use, not in infrastructure. Fewer people use broadband in some of our rural communities, but the infrastructure in many communities, as I said before, is better. But in general, the broadband prices in Minnesota and the U.S. are higher and our speeds are slower than in our global competitors. We have slower service and we pay more for it. And there are multiple reasons for that, but it's something that we really have to come to grips with if we're going to be globally competitive, because this is a key part of our economic competitiveness. On the good side, infrastructure and usage are improving. We're going in the right direction, but quite frankly, we're not keeping up. This unreadable chart shows the U.S. in red there, and that we're about 16th in broadband penetration. This is the number of users per 100 people. This is an international study that was done. There are two of them that are done every year, and we're usually in the mid-teens now. We are not global competitors. That chart is also in the handout I've given you, but just to cite some of the countries that are ahead of us, Korea, Hong Kong, the Netherlands, Denmark, Canada, Switzerland, Taiwan, Belgium, Iceland, Sweden, Norway, Israel, Japan, Finland, and Singapore are all ahead of us in terms of broadband penetration. So this is important. I mean, if we don't use it, we're going to be less globally competitive. And if people don't use it, it's pretty tough to attract investment. And this is why we actually launched the Get Broadband program. Now, some countries have some major fiber deployments. You hear a lot now about fiber to the home. That's the technology today. It may not be the technology in the future, but today that's the best technology for bringing broadband to the home, which has the greatest speed. All these countries have major fiber-to-the-premise projects going on. When we talk about U.S. broadband, the FCC has a definition of broadband that, quite frankly, is laughable on global terms. The FCC defines broadband as 200 kilobits per second in one direction, generally coming in, because that's where the way our systems are built, we get higher speed coming in than going out. That's the FCC definition of broadband. In other parts of the world, it's 50 megabits per second, again, way faster, or in some parts of the world, getting gigabit-level service, or 1,000 megabits per second in both directions. So the type of broadband that we have is much slower than what is available in other parts of the world. And this is an important issue, and it's something we have to deal with, because this is part of actually the out-migration of jobs and industries to other parts of the world. We need to have a world-class type of telecommunications infrastructure if we're going to compete in the knowledge economy. About a year and a half ago, we created a broadband vision for Minnesota. And I just want to read it for a second. To ensure a high quality of life and a globally competitive future for its citizens, businesses, and communities, Minnesota is committed to making the necessary investment to become a world leader in the universal deployment and use of ultra-high-speed next-generation broadband. Simple statement, but the reality is that this is going to be an expensive investment. It is in all the countries that have already done it, that have already deployed it. And it's going to take the public and private sectors working together if we're going to be able to compete. We got a great quote from the governor a couple years ago. He said, "Broadband is as important to future economic development as electricity was some years ago." And this was from the governor speaking at our policy conference a year and a half ago. The interesting thing about this statement was he made it from Hong Kong. And it was 11 o'clock at Hong Kong. It was 9 o'clock in St. Cloud where we held the conference. He made it on a laptop from his hotel room with a $50 webcam. Now, that's something we can all do from our own homes and our own offices. It's very simple technology. The reality of it is that's not a good enough broadband connection to do what we really need to do to compete, which is to be able to have high definition, high quality video telecommunication between multiple parties. Ideally, it'd be nice to have a high definition video conference with the governor from four different states having a dialogue about what they're doing on this issue. That's really what we have to get to in terms of our telecommunication capacity. But the governor recognized the importance of this issue, and he's been a supporter. At the time we created this vision, we also generated some principles that we think are really important to guiding our development. And I really want to encourage you to look at these, because I think they're a good screen for all the different kinds of proposals you get over the course of the session. The first principle is ubiquity. That's our fancy foundation term for everybody's got to have it, needs to be everywhere. As a practical matter, everybody's not going to get it at once. There's some places that are going to get it first, but everybody needs to have it. It needs to be symmetric in that it's a high speed in both directions. Most of the systems that deliver broadband were designed around pushing content out to you. And so you have high speeds coming in, but now so many people are working from their homes, we actually have to have high speed going in both directions. It has to be affordable. This is an issue, you know, for us. It can't just be for people who can spend a lot of money. There needs to be competition. We know that if there's competition in telecommunications, services improve, prices go down. It's a good thing, and we embrace it wholeheartedly. It needs to be world-class, meaning we have to look at the world, what's available in the world, and that's the standard we have to shoot for. Again, the FCC definition is such a low bar that everybody crosses it. And over 90% of Minnesota right now, 90% of the communities have that basic level broadband. That we have now. That's not what we need to compete. We need to have world-class broadband if we're going to compete. There has to be collaboration. This is going to be a big investment to get up to that world-class standard. If we look to where it's been successful in the world, it's because there was collaboration between the public and private sectors. And we add the neutrality principle because today fiber is probably the most attractive in terms of bandwidth and speed, but tomorrow it might be something else. So the important thing is that we figure out how we can get to this world-class broadband. As I said, a couple years ago, we created this Get Broadband program because it attacked our first objective, which is get people using broadband, get people to understand, whether it's businesses, schools, healthcare organizations, governments, general public, to understand what it takes. We created this program, so we give out small grants, $15,000 matching grants to communities. They raise that money matching money themselves, and we conduct a lot of educational activities tailored at each of those sectors so that they learn what they can do with broadband. And it's been a successful program. We're now involved in 29 communities across the state. What we have found is that the take rates go up dramatically. You know, the take rates are increasing anyways in Minnesota, but in communities that run the Get Broadband program, they're increasing at a much faster rate. And so we're pleased with that. So where's the broadband infrastructure investment occurring? Surprisingly, it's more in rural areas than in urban areas. If we look to where the really robust systems, the ones that can provide this megabit and 100 megabit and greater service, actually it's in rural communities. There are about 10 communities right now in Minnesota that have fiber to every home. And that is not available anywhere in the metro area. If you look to see where it's done, there are a couple of co-ops that have done it. Consolidated in Brainerd and Paul Bunyan up in Bemidji have actually expanded in a number of communities where they're providing fiber to the home in every community. It's an incredible investment. There are municipal deployments. Windham, Minnesota has a municipal internet service provider that provides voice, video, and data to every home. And we're seeing open networks. Now, I want to talk a little bit about all of these because all of them, in some way, shape, or form, have public and private sectors working together. Every single one of them. The co-ops they have made some great investments, but in general, they're heavily subsidized by the federal government through some mechanisms that are available there. They're hard to use. There's not that many people or organizations that can use them, but those are heavily subsidized. Obviously, municipal deployments and open networks are too. And I want to talk a little bit about open networks just because this is a new business model that we're really intrigued by. We've seen it in use in other parts of the world, and it's just now coming into the United States, and it's something I think you should be aware of. It's not right for every community. You know, there are different approaches, you know, different ways to skin this cat in every community, but it's something that's worth looking at. And there are a few communities that are looking at this right now. On the Iron Range, there's a project now that's looking at this structure. Monticello is looking at this structure. There are a number of communities that have looked at it, and right now it's actually being deployed in Utah right now in 14 different communities. But this is a structure where the municipalities or the cities with private parties own the infrastructure. They go out and build the fiber. They build out the pathway to your home, and then private companies compete on that network to provide the service. So you get competition between private providers that that provide the retail service, the voice, video, and data, but the infrastructure is owned by either the municipalities or a partnership between the cities and private parties. And so it is an intriguing model because it provides the cheapest financing for the infrastructure, but it provides competition on the retail level. So it's worth looking at. You know, again, there are some Minnesota communities that are looking at this now. It's common in Europe. There are a number of countries in Europe that have this model in place now, and they're looking at it in Utah. So we're intrigued by it because it seems to be a good way to accomplish many different objectives. Just to summarize again, with a couple of comments about things that I want to encourage you to consider. First, to encourage investment. Look at see what you can. You know, when you get people bringing you bills all the time to do all kinds of things. I just ask that you look at them and see if it encourages investment, if it encourages creativity and flexibility. What we don't want are things that restrict that, because this is a difficult challenge for us. It's a critical challenge if we're going to be successful in the future. And so we just want to make sure that, you know, new actions don't make it more difficult or cut certain people out of the market or make it more difficult to do this. Look for ways to encourage that. And the other thing I want to encourage you to do is look at investing along with the local communities. As I said before, there isn't any major investment right now other than possibly Verizon, who's doing this in some of their markets. But across most of the world and across most of the U.S. right now, any fiber deployments have some type of public sector subsidy. It just, you know, it doesn't pencil out real well. It's expensive, but it's critical to our economic future. And so I want to encourage you, you know, if you get proposals, to look at investing along with local communities. There are some communities that say this is important enough to us that we're going to put our money into it, and I just want to encourage you to look for ways to partner with them. So that, my fast and long-winded presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. I know this is an important issue for you, and I'd be happy to.
Good presentation. I don't think there's anybody that would disagree with the need out there, you know, that we have to do this. But some people would argue, let the marketplace kind of take care of itself, and how do you pay for it? What's the price tag? And, I mean, we all know that someday, somehow, it should get done, but, I mean, what would be the price tag to do the whole rural area, you know? I mean, it'd be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of million dollars, I would think.
Mr. Chairman,
we know the need. We all agree with that.
Mr. Chairman, you raised the essential dilemma, and the problem, quite frankly, with the marketplace is that this doesn't pay for itself. I mean, it's, you know, marketplace we could pay for part of it, but it's too expensive. And so the dilemma we ask is, do we wait? You know, and other parts of the world are actually making that investment, and so it's a tough choice. I think you hit the nail on the head.
And I suppose what's being done now is kind of the cherry-picking stuff where the concentration and where it pays for itself. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, I maybe missed this, but did you address how wireless fits into this? I mean, the community I represent is initiating a city-owned or contracted wireless operation throughout the community. Can it be provided under current technology at the speeds that you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, good question. Because wireless does fit into this. Right now, wireless doesn't provide the speed that these global standards, are providing. It's actually comparable to. It's not that different from the cable modems. It's a little slower than the cable modems, and maybe it's comparable to DSL type of service. The main benefit to wireless right now is it provides much cheaper service. It's fairly easy. It's cheaper to put up a tower and provide wireless service, and so that tends to provide. It actually serves a couple of niches. It serves the people who can afford a computer in their home, but can't afford, you know, $30, $40, or $50 for the other types of broadband services. It also is a way to reach mobile users, you know, emergency responders, then can get broadband in their vehicles, and you obviously can't do that with a fiber optic cable. You know, there's no way to travel with hook wired up. So wireless provides some very important niche capabilities today. Again, those people who can't afford conventional service or the mobile service, and also it's you know, you can provide broadband in the parks and other places that some people think is attractive. But as a long-term strategy, right now, wireless doesn't serve or doesn't provide the speed or bandwidth that we need to catch up to the rest of the world. So it's important today. I don't mean to discount that. It just doesn't appear to be fast enough or reliable enough to do the kinds of things that these higher speed services are providing.
Senator Scoyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Fields. When you're talking about the financing of this network, isn't part of this service that's being packaged in there is the cable TV, and isn't that helping to bear part of the cost of the broadband? They get the TV and the broadband and the voice phone all at, on one line?
Mr. Chairman,
Fails.
Senator, absolutely. Right now, all of the major providers are converging. The cable companies want to provide, in addition to television, they want to provide voice telephone service and data. The telephone companies want to provide video and internet. They're all actually trying to provide all of them because you really need all three revenue streams. And some are adding wireless to that, too, wireless cell phone into a fourth service. You really need all that if you're going to justify any investment. The problem is it's not enough. Right now, fiber deployments are running, you know, maybe $1,500 per household. What's interesting, and again, I want to bring this back to why this is so critical. Broadband has been around long enough now that we can there have been some interesting studies that actually show the communities that have broadband grow faster than the ones that don't. Carnegie Mellon and Harvard just completed a major study last year to confirm what we kind of knew intuitively, that, you know, if you have it, you're probably going to grow faster. Now they can document that. An interesting part of that study was that it showed that houses that had fiber to the home sold for more than the ones that don't. So even though it's expensive, and it probably can't be supported entirely by what customers pay for the voice, video, and data services, it is a good investment, both for the consumer or for and the business and the institution, but also for the community at large. They tend to grow faster, create more jobs. So figuring out how to cover this is not easy, but right now it's really rare. Well, I'll back up. I haven't seen anybody that's been able to provide it in the U.S. or even in other parts of the world without some type of subsidy, with the exception of Korea, who has the ability to run a fiber cable into some, you know, housing complexes that have thousands of units in them, and it's so much cheaper to provide service in that kind of density that starts to become cost effective.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Fields, do you have any information with regard to how many of our school districts in the state have broadband capacity?
Mr. Fields.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, I've seen conflicting data on it. I've seen some data that says most of them are served, if I mention that to the schools, they look at me like I'm from another planet, because apparently there's some that are not. So I don't have good data on it, but it's obviously education is a strong user. They're one of the pillars of our Get Broadband program. They're strong users of it. They need, you know, they need this kind of bandwidth that we're talking about. And if I can digress about schools just for a second, I want to encourage you that any solution you look at for the schools, to make sure that it can be leveraged in the local community. One of the problems we've had in the past, and schools have done this, governments have done this, hospitals have done this, even businesses. Those big, what I call industrial-sized users, they are so big that sometimes they can come up with a solution that works just for them, and when that happens, nobody else in the community benefits from that investment. And so when you look to solutions, you want something that works for the schools to also work for all of the other users in the community. And the best example of that is in Brainerd, where the school system was going, as part of a major school expansion, had $1 million budgeted for telecommunications infrastructure. Instead of doing their own solution, they partnered with a local telephone co-op. They combined funds, and with that, they were able to get enough funds to build out fiber to every home in Brainerd, which obviously helps the schools a lot because there's a lot of school home-based applications for the schools. So schools obviously need it, but those solutions need to be combined with, you know, with all of the other sectors in a local community.
Senator Cook.
Well, thank you, Chair. My question sort of has to do with, I noticed one of your principles is neutrality, and it sort of dovetails on what Senator Scoy was saying, that, you know, these days the technology is such that it's not voice and cable TV. These companies can offer all of these services. And I'm wondering if you, and so one of your principles being neutrality, I appreciate that. I wonder if there are different restrictions that the government places on different sectors that perhaps are hindering some of this growth in broadband.
Mr. Fields.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, with all due respect to governmental agency or legislative bodies, the regulatory situation for broadband is a mess because we have different and it, not because anybody messed up, but because all of those technologies developed at different times, different eras, and they were all regulated differently. So to say there's a level playing field is you know it just doesn't exist. And so at times I've watched the Minnesota legislature try to deal with that, and it's huge. It's you know, and at times Blandin's looked at that, and we go, you know, we back away because it's so hard to get a handle on. The wireless industry is very unregulated. Cable has a certain set of regulations. You know, the DSL service comes out of the telephone industry, which has a different set of regulations. You know, at times they've tried to carve out slices of this at the federal level, and it's just it's definitely a hindrance because not only are they all regulated differently, which makes it more complicated for them to compete, but it creates a level of uncertainty because if you want to, you know, make investments that are going to last 20 years or longer, you want to know the regulatory environment you're in, and so it's very difficult. And I, you know, we've been baffled by that, and so if you want us to come back with some comments on that, we need a longer session. So it's a good question.
Did you have a follow-up?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, does it make sense to you to conceptualize any of this for communities as a utility, or how would you handle that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, actually some of the communities that have started to provide their own municipal service have done it as a utility. Actually, very similar to an electric utility or a water and gas, you know, they've operated it that manner. And the communities that are operating open networks have also looked at it as a utility, where they still have private providers provide the retail service, but they look at the infrastructure as a utility. And to draw an analogy, can you imagine if Federal Express and DHL and the post office all building roads to your home? You know, it would seem like a pretty major redundant type of investment. And so the utility model is one that's in place, it's becoming much more common, and that's actually how a number of other countries have approached it, where they provide the infrastructure and the utility. What has been most intriguing to us is seeing this open network model, because the retail providers then compete on that, and then you get competition too. The criticism of utilities is sometimes you don't have competition, and that in some communities they're so small that it would be actually difficult to have competition. But other than that, it's we usually embrace it.
Senator Tavassoni.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Fields, I'm not sure I agree with you on your talking about your shift away from a natural resource-based economy, because I know up in my area our natural resource-based economy is our economy. And I think the farmers will probably think that they have a natural resource-based economy also. But at any rate, this particular idea is a good one. The problem with it is, as the chairman alluded to earlier, is the cost and who's going to pay for it. And the bigger problem is that this is based on the idea of a pipe going into people's homes, and that several providers can access the pipe. And then supposedly the competition will bring down the cost of the services to the people, and you'll actually get a faster and better service. The experience that people have had in different parts of the country on this is that only about 30% of the people tap into it, because of the fact that they've already got some kind of service provider and they're happy with it. And so in order to get an economy of scale here that actually works, you need way more than 30%, and you need to have big numbers. And I think in rural Minnesota, our problem is who's going to pay. Now, I think Blandin should be willing to put up to $65 million so that the Iron Range can put it in, and that would be great. But having said that, I don't know that Blandon is willing to put it in. So the dollar figure is the thing that continues to be the problem, and whether or not the proliferation of the service to the individual homes is something that can actually end up paying for it. And at 30%, I don't think it's a big enough number, and that's in a nutshell part of the problem of deploying the service.
Okay, we have a response, and we better move along.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomassoni, I apologize if I said anything disparaging about natural resource economy. I'm mainly commenting on the change in employment across the state. You see more knowledge jobs coming up. But just to respond to your point about Blandon, as a matter of fact, the foundation is looking at investing in the Iron Range project, and we're trying to figure out where we can make a difference. So we're
that's a good thing.
We're looking at it. Yeah.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Next presentation will be Twin Cities Rise. Mike Bingham. Identify yourselves for the tape and tell us the good things you're doing, okay?
Thank you. I'm Mike Bingham, president of Twin Cities Rise.
I'm Andre Corbett with Twin Cities Rise.
Okay.
I'd also like to acknowledge that we have two other individuals affiliated with the organization here today. Across my left shoulder, Mary Rosenthal is a board member of Twin Cities Rise, and Kathy Lawrence is a staffer. I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking about the organization. Some of you know as well, and for some of you, this will be a new story. And then I'll hand it over to Andre, who's a graduate of the program, and he'll give you a sense of a little bit about his personal story. Andre is also an employee of Twin Cities Rise. About five of our total of 35 employees are actually graduates of the program. So he's here to give you a sense of what a graduate is like, but also note that he's an employee of the program as well. What I'm referring to is this document that should have been handed out. I hope all of you have it somewhere in your pile. I'll give you a minute to get to it.
Did they give it to everybody? We have this. They don't get paid. Got this annual report. Looks.
Yeah, I didn't hand that out.
Nice for me to understand.
Yeah, I didn't hand that one out, Senator, although I can do it at some point. I handed out.
Yeah, this is a good reference.
Yeah, isn't that a good reference?
But you handed out.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Our program, okay, condensed.
Yep. Yeah.
But this is pretty meaningful.
Isn't that terrific? Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to leave you with two messages today. The first is we're a job training program that's getting great results that are very quantifiable dealing with a difficult population. That's message number one. Message number two is that the way we're paid, the payment mechanism to Twin Cities Rise, is something that this committee may want to consider for broader application across the job training and potentially other programs, and I'm going to highlight both of those issues as I go through here. First of all, just going through this document I handed out, our program itself provides area employers with skilled entry-level employees, mostly from communities of color. We're a job training program, so we run hard and soft skill courses. And what we are most proud of is that the graduates of our program earn about $24,600 a year plus benefits. And as you'll see later on in one of the points there, before they came into the program, they earned about $1,200. So whatever that percentage increase is, it's pretty astronomical, and that really points to the power of our program. We serve mostly the African-American community. About 65% of our graduates are African-Americans, and the rest are either North African or Caucasian. And then finally, at the end of our program here, we're starting two new offices, one in Minneapolis and one in St. Paul, that will augment our existing two offices focused on younger men who are currently living a drug or gang lifestyle. The current demographic that we serve are slightly older people who have either come out of prison or been dependent upon state or county or other resources. So we're going after this younger population with the idea get to them before they their lives begin to spin out of control. Just as background, the second point here, our contract with the state, it is innovative in that it's not an outright grant, it's an allocation, and then we submit to DEED on a regular basis how many individuals we actually trained who got a living wage job that we define as at least $10 an hour plus health care benefits, and we get a payment upon placement from DEED and a payment upon one-year job retention. So the way it works is if we don't hit our target for the number of graduates, we actually do not max out our payment from DEED. So we call this a pay-for-performance or a pay-for-placement contract that mimics much much of the activity in the private sector. I like that because as a leader of an organization, it helps me hold my staff accountable to deliver results. And I think, obviously, it makes good policy sense for both taxpayers and for the government. At the end of the day, if you're going to contract with an outside vendor, which is the way it what we really are to the government, that you should demand that we actually deliver the results we're promising. And that's the innovative contract and way of paying that I think the committee may want to consider that could have broader applications. And the third point down here under our contract, we've shown about a 70% return on investment to taxpayers to date. And as our graduates continue to work for their lifetime, we think that could go up to 400%. The two components of the return on investment are the taxes paid of our graduates. So before they come into the program, obviously, if you earn $1,200 a year, you're not paying taxes. And then the second component is the reduced use of social services. And when the program was started about 13 years ago, the State Demographer Office came up with the basic underlying data for us to perform those calculations. I've talked about before, we take people who are in pretty desperate economic conditions. They're either coming out of jail or they're on welfare. That's why they earned income before they came into the program. The number here is 1,478. These are basically people who are pretty well unemployable before they come into the program. Not all fit into that category, but many do, and especially those that the state pays for. We have many different categories of graduates. The state pays for the highest category, those graduates who actually get a living wage job with health care benefits. I mentioned before the contract is administered by DEED. The state government accounts for only 12% of our budget. The rest of the budget I either raise privately through individuals and foundations or employers pay as a fee when we place a graduate at an employer. Our proposal, as I've talked about before, is that this payment mechanism may have broader applications, and we are asking for more dollars in the current biennium to reflect our continued growth and the opening of these two offices that we're calling a Wally Place. Because of the payment mechanism, though, unless we graduate more people, we will not max out on that payment, so it holds us accountable. The final point on the first page, why do this? I think it sends a message of accountability and innovation are rewarded for those individuals seeking dollars from the state of Minnesota. It pays for the desired outcome, which is getting individuals out of poverty, which is what we all want, not for process, which is training. Training is the process we go through, and that's an important process. But at the end of the day, if you train people but they don't get out of poverty, I'm not sure the dollars are particularly well spent. And then if you flip it over, people often ask, is Twin Cities Rise cost-effective? For those of you who knew us 10 years ago, the answer was probably not. We were a very small program with a lot of overhead. Now we are a fairly large program. Last year we served in some way about 1,300 individuals. Now, of course, not all of those individuals graduated, but if you start getting to the scale we're at, our cost per participant comes way down. And as I benchmark us both locally and nationally, we're very, very cost competitive. I would also argue that if you just look at cost, you're missing the point of any job training program. The point is, for the cost, how much reward is our society or culture getting? And that's why I talk about return on investment more than I talk about cost. Although cost is important, I think more important is when people leave the program, how long do they pay taxes and do they use social services anymore? And again, as I mentioned, short-term programs are cheaper. There are many short-term programs, many of them run by the state. I think we augment those very well. And then finally, who do we help? Well, as mentioned before, we service mostly African Americans. 50% of our participants have a criminal record. 75% have a history of alcohol, substance abuse. The average reading level when we test them is junior high, although everybody coming into our program has a GED or a high school diploma. Then three-quarters are unemployed when they come into the program. So I thought I'd hold questions to the end and now hand it over to Andre, and he'll say a few words about his background and the impact that TCR has had on him personally. Andre.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Andre, and identify yourself for the tape.
Andre Corbett with the Twin Cities Rise. Good afternoon, Chair and Senators. It is truly a pleasure to be here. As far as my background, I dropped out of high school when I was in 10th grade. My mom was using drugs. My father wasn't around. And I moved out and got an apartment on my own, and it was either school or work, and I chose to get a job instead of continuing in school. Because of that, you know, kind of dibble-dabbled in the street life, gang activity. I've sold drugs. I've carried pistols. I robbed people. That was the lifestyle that I was living at that age. Even though I did go back to high school and graduate, because of a stupid choice that I made, I ended up robbing somebody and went to prison for 3.5 years. And not only from that one, but from that one that I did do, I got charged with 2 robberies that I did not do. And I realize now today that if I never would have put myself in that position in the first place, that I wouldn't have been put in a position to be charged with the other 2 robberies. But when I was in prison, I heard about Twin Cities Rise and the empowerment training program. And for me, the empowerment, besides the hard skills that I learned at Twin Cities Rise of computers, of brushing up on reading and writing and interviewing techniques, the empowerment skills training really had the deepest impact on my life. It gave me a sense of being lovable, valuable, and important, which we refer to as core values. And because of that, now today, I see everybody in this room and everybody that I come across as being lovable, valuable, and important. So now today, I will not, you know, I will not cause anybody to have any hurt or any pain because of something that I do. It makes it a lot more difficult to sell drugs to people. It makes it a lot more difficult to rob people because I now see them just as I see myself. And I realize if I violate them, I violate myself. I've only been out of prison for 13 months, you know, and to make this the transformation and change that I know would not have happened without Twin Cities Rise, because I've researched other programs that would be beneficial, that claim to be beneficial for ex-offenders, and realistically, Twin Cities Rise was the bang for the buck for me, plain and simple. Now today, besides working, I'm starting my second semester of college. I sit on the ex-offender advisory board and just really want to do a whole lot to impact my community in a positive. And through the empowerment the soft skills at Twin Cities Rise is where all of this came about. And it really has had the biggest impact on my life. Like I said, it just makes it a lot harder. I see everybody in here as my equal, as my fellow brother, my fellow sister, and it just makes it more difficult to go out and cause trouble. I'd rather struggle on my own rather than put somebody else in jeopardy. And I realize the impact that I've had on the community in a sense of, for the 3.5 years I was incarcerated, probably cost taxpayers about $100,000. My income went from nothing last year to roughly $23,000 this year. I'm able to afford my own place. I'm able to maintain my bills, keep food on my table and everything like that. And without Twin Cities Rise, I know for a fact that I would probably be out there selling drugs, be robbing people right now if it wasn't for Twin Cities Rise. And that's what I have to share. Thank you.
Yeah, what a great success story there.
Congratulations, and keep it up, Andre.
Thank you, Chair.
Are there any questions for either Andre or myself?
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Bingham, how often now you have the unique situation where you claim back your successes and get paid that way.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you hit that allocation as a matter of course? Do you hit the maximum of that in recent history over the past few years?
The last two bienniums we have hit the max. I think the biennium that we're just ending now, we probably maxed out about a month or two before the end of the 2 years. If our allocation goes up, we have to grow extensively in order to hit the max. So, and part of this pay for placement contracting changes the role of government a little bit. The role becomes one of much like the government purchases healthcare now. You put out RFPs, you try to get the best deal you can from the local vendors, negotiate and so forth. I view if this is to be a policy change, that's how it would be. You'd say, here's the desired outcome we're looking for, and you'd seek RFPs and bids from social service agencies who could meet that desired outcome. So that there would have to be a sort of a change in mindset in order for this thing to this sort of payment mechanism to grow.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bingham. I'm just trying to get a feel for the scope of how many people you've been working with. You said you worked with 1,300. You know, I don't. You didn't obviously didn't run all of those through the full treatment programs. But how many people did you submit to the state for reimbursement under this $305,000?
The way our we actually run several programs, so that 1,300 individuals reflects some programming of individuals who are in jail only, not the training outside of jail and so forth. For the program we're talking about today, at any given time we'll have about 200 people in the program, and there's a huge churn at the beginning. People come, they find out we're not right for them. They don't want to attend classes. We actually run a drug test. We have a dress code and so forth. So approximately one out of five individuals makes it through our entire programming. And those are the individuals that the state of Minnesota pays for. There are another group of that one out of five, about another one out of five, that achieve some other kind of outcome that's short of this outcome. So maybe they get a job without health care. The state doesn't pay for them. Okay, so we have multiple levels of outcome depending on how long a person's willing to stick with us. The state only pays for the highest level of outcome, which is a job that pays on average $25,000 with health care benefits.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. And just do you have other funding sources besides the state?
We get a little bit of money from adult basic education. That's going away. I expect that will be zero this year. And then the rest of our money is either fees paid to us by employers who hire our graduates, or it is raised through private philanthropy.
That's real, real interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know the numbers on the payback, if you can figure it out, you know, the money the state would save, for example, on welfare, prisons. Then they pay taxes, too, when they're working. Yeah. And the small price that I think we pay up front as taxpayers, I would think the return on investment would be pretty good payoff.
Yeah, we show for a typical grad the break even after you look at all their training costs is about 3 or 4 years out, and then the rest is gravy. That's where the return on investment comes. And
go ahead. Senator Bach is just
well, chuckling. Mr. President, that was spoken like a true policy chair.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Yeah, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bingham, why would, I guess I'm wondering, what's the hook? Andrew, why did you want to do this? Because you clearly could make more money doing something else, right? You know, and I'm just wondering where you buy in to what they have to offer.
It's a lot of more ways to make more money, illegal ways. But from being incarcerated, I noticed a lot of guys that I've been incarcerated with really want to change. Nobody wants to go back to that lifestyle that they was in. But when they get out and they go to other programs and they're trying to make that change and they don't get any results, you go to one place, try to find something, they send you to another place. But one thing about Twin Cities Rise is that they really do everything that they say that they're going to do, and that's really what hooked me in. It was my support system. I don't have any family up here, but all the staff there really gave me the support that I needed to continue my positive change, and I could pull any of them to the side, include a mic, and sit down, you know, for a quick 2 or 3 minute conversation if I'm having any doubts or need that support, and that support of the staff is really what pulled me in after I started the program.
Senator, if I may say, when we started the program 12 years ago, when Steve Rothschild started the program, there was a fairly extensive screening process, including a test and a psychological interview, because our program's expensive and we didn't want to waste money on people who weren't ready to change. It didn't work. And it's very difficult to predict who's willing to change their life. Everybody who comes to your door wants to change their life. They're unhappy. Otherwise, they wouldn't come to your door, but it's difficult to predict who's going to persevere through all the things you have to do to change your life, including saying goodbye to friends and loved ones who may not be the best influence on you. So the advice we got from individuals in this field is let the program be the screen. In other words, just have people come and set the program rules and set the expectations and tell them what the outcome is going to be, and then let the individual screen themselves out based on their either acceptance or non-acceptance of the accountability it takes to persevere through our program. But Andre went through faster than most. A typical person's with us about 16 months. So it's a long-term investment we make in people.
Thank you.
Very good. Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For both of you, if you would comment on your observations of whether or not there was adequate preparation within the correctional system for reentry into the community.
Personally speaking, I was at Faribault Minimum my last year or so, and there was supposed to be a pre-release class. There was nothing. I just got a whole bunch of papers with a whole bunch of information. A lot of the contact information on it was relatively old. I was released December 29th of 05, and a lot of the contact stuff was like 02 and 03. So for me personally speaking, and being incarcerated, there was no pre-release, nothing to really prepare me for getting out. Twin Cities Rise, through their Project Reentry program that I was involved in, was probably the closest thing to it.
One of our strategic goals, if we can figure out how to do it financially, is to actually start a program entirely in a correctional facility. Because one of the biggest obstacles we have when men are out is they have unstable housing and they have all those access to drugs and alcohol and relationships that they shouldn't be in again. Well, theoretically, while they're in jail, they don't have access to all that and they have stable housing. So we're thinking if we can drive an entire program into a correctional facility, when these men come out, they'll be job ready. The trick there is, A, getting a partner to do that because it represents a significant change within a correctional facility. And then, B, it cost about $750,000 to start up a separate office for Twin Cities Rise. You think about all the staff and other issues. So, but that is one of our, if you look at our major strategic initiatives for this year, that is one of our initiatives is to make headway in that area.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Very good story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got three confirmations on this afternoon's meeting. I don't think they'll take too long. I'm not sure of that. But Mr. Cunningham, you're first. James A. Cunningham, Jr., Bureau of Mediation Services. And I think we have some resumes or in your file. So you're Mr. Cunningham, you may proceed. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good afternoon. You have in your materials an overview of the Bureau of Mediation Services. I did not include any personal information, so I'll take the briefest of time to tell you a little bit about me and about the Bureau and have time, if the chair so pleases, to answer any questions you may have. First of all, I'm going to apologize a little bit. Like a lot of folks, I am fighting off a cold, and unfortunately for me, my voice is the first thing to go. So before I'm done here, I may go from my normal baritone to sound like Alvin or one of the other two chipmunks by the time we're done here, so I will apologize. In terms of background, I received my bachelor's and my law degree from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. After graduating from law school, I clerked for a federal judge in Milwaukee for a year, and then I came here to Minnesota to work for the Ryder Bennett Law Firm. From my time here until now, I have about 17 years being involved in public sector employment and labor relations. After I was done at Ryder Bennett, I worked in-house at the Minneapolis Public School District and for the city of Minneapolis, doing labor and employment and collective bargaining in both areas. I've been commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services since February 2003. The Bureau has a very succinct mission, and that is to promote stable and constructive labor relations throughout the state. We do that predominantly by traveling all over the state, our mediators to help mediate collective bargaining disputes. Our the employees of the Bureau on average spend about between 150 and 175,000 miles on the road driving to communities throughout the state. We work with the state, all counties, cities, and school districts. I'm proud to say that our small fleet of cars has been E85 compliant since 2002, so we are well ahead of the curve on that one. When we talk about how to quantitatively measure the Bureau's work, it's a little tougher simply because we don't have any actual stake in the outcome of a dispute. We really come to kind of try to add value to the parties to allow them to find the tools to reach agreement. Conversely, we don't take it as a success for us if the parties reach mediation because, quite frankly, it's their agreement to work with and we're just there to help them. Likewise, I don't personally take it personal if things don't go right and there is a some type of ongoing problem, but we really work hard to make certain that the public sector employees and employers in the state work together as conducively as possible. And I do have a few numbers in that regard. Over the last four fiscal years, the Bureau has received more than 2,500 individual petitions for mediation help. In managing those petitions, we've done over 3,700 individual meetings with parties. We have about 5,000, again, over the last 4 years, in terms of meetings on all of the activities that the Bureau is responsible for mediation being the biggest percentage of those. Despite all of those meetings over the past four fiscal years, I'm proud to say that we've only had 8 strikes in the public sector in the state of Minnesota. And I will point out for the public record that 3 of those happened before I came on board. So I think, what that really states is that the Bureau provides, I think, a real valuable services to the citizens of the state in allowing employers and employees to work together conducively. With regard to future challenges, one of the biggest challenges we're faced with now as an agency is trying to help the parties find some answers with regard to what is becoming and has become the biggest impediment to effective settlement, and that is health insurance, providing health insurance for their employees. So I scour the internet, conferences, scholarly journals, et cetera, trying to see what other groups are doing to try to answer some of those questions. We have some meetings that we do with our mediation brethren in Wisconsin and Iowa, and again, the last time we all got together, it was specifically to share information on what people were doing with regard to health care. We're yet to find the magic bullet, so to speak, but we're actively looking to see if we can find ways to help employers and employees deal with that big issue. The other thing we're looking to do going forward is to continue to promote interest-based collective bargaining. That is also known as win-win bargaining. It's when it's a paradigm shift from what people think of as traditional collective bargaining, which is kind of a win-lose. You get something and the other side gives something up. In interest-based collective bargaining, both sides kind of look to the whole of the organization and do what's best for the organization. And we've been, over the past 4 years, we've done a lot to try to introduce that concept to people whenever possible, and we're going to continue to do that in the upcoming future. Lastly, the thing that I'm always interested in working on is increasing our agency's efficiency. When I first started, I thought it was inefficient. All of our mediators are housed in St. Paul in our office, and they travel outstate from there. And we've tried some other approaches to try to have some satellite offices, et cetera, so we can try to diminish some of those travel costs, and we've had some limited success, but we're still working on that. So those are the big areas kind of for the future going forward that we're going to be pursuing. We're going to continue to provide what I think is a very valuable service to the citizens already. We're going to continue to do that to the best of our ability and then see where else we can do to improve the collective bargaining environment in the state.
Very good. Questions of Mr. Cunningham. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cunningham, in the interest of full disclosure, sources of compensation, it lists you as the owner of Cunningham Consulting Group. Can you tell me what kind of work that business does?
Mr. Chair, it is a consulting business that we do training in sexual harassment, how to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace.
And
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, there's no opportunity for any conflict of interest between the job you hold and the business you own.
Mr. Chair, Cutting Senator, up. No, Senator, it is not.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. I think we, somebody, the motion would be that somebody moves that the committee recommend that the appointment of Commissioner Cunningham be confirmed. Is there any questions to Senator Scheidt? Any further discussion? Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the letter from Governor Pawlenty, and he it's a different kind of letter than we have, for example, with Mr. McElroy, who's coming up. The one for Mr. Cunningham says, I designate the commissioner to continue, and that he was previously confirmed. And so I'm questioning whether the proper motion should be that we just approve the continuation of the service of Commissioner Cunningham.
I am of the opinion that we have to reconfirm. I mean, the governor was just reelected, and I think he starts with a new team, and he's recommending, and I don't think it's so I think we have to do it, in my opinion. So,
well, Mr. Chair, have you?
And I think somebody researched it, too, on our part. I don't know if it was Mr. Fuller. Do you agree that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Neville, Peter Watts in our office looked at it, went through the legislative history, and issued an opinion that the terms ended with the term of the governor. And I have a copy downstairs of that opinion. It seemed pretty compelling to me if you look at the legislative history. When they talk about a vacancy in the office, it was pretty clear that it was not at the end of the term. It was if you left before the end of your term, and it was done to accommodate the situation when Governor Anderson became a senator and Lieutenant Governor Purvis took over. It was in response to that, the language that the governor's office was relying on. If you look at the legislative history, it doesn't seem to support their opinion.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Neville.
I haven't seen the opinion and not familiar with the legislative history. But it must be significant that the governor used different language for this commissioner than he did for example, for Mr. McElroy, who's coming up, where it's a brand new appointment, and so I'd like to know a little bit more why the governor used different language in his letter before I.
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman.
Can we get a copy of the memo?
Right now, you want me to see that?
Well,
somebody else do it.
Oh, it's in a file somewhere. Okay. Senator Neville, the governor did get an opinion from the governor's council that expressed the viewpoint, the opinion that they did not have to be confirmed. And so the Watson memo was in response to that. So at some point in time, I don't know if his memo has changed anybody's thinking, but at one point in time, the thinking of the governor's legal advisor was that sitting commissioners did not have to be reconfirmed upon reelection of a sitting governor.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator, how are we going to resolve it?
Well, I mean, the resolve that you're after and the governor's after, I would think, is to appoint these people. And I, for one, and particularly as a Democrat, I'm going to support all three candidates today. So, I mean, that why worry about the words as much as the appointments? I think, I mean, I don't know. That's
well,
all I feel.
Mr. Chair, the answer to that is because
there's a disagreement, we're going to go forward here today.
I understand. I'm just creating
confirmation to Mr. Cunningham, and we'll get you that copy of our counsel's.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me answer the question. It's precedent. So if we confirm commissioners who are already in office where there's no dispute, is there a waiver when there is a dispute? And so I mean, obviously you can have the vote as you wish today, and I'm not going to stand in the way of this, of any of them, frankly, today, but I just don't want it to be understood that this constitutes a waiver. If there's a commissioner later on that there is a disagreement over, if the governor decides to assert that position.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator, or right, Mr. Fuller.
Senator, I think possibly this could be resolved by the notion that the committee is simply recommending an action, and so that at the next level on the floor, once you have the memo, you can make a decision whether or not you want to pursue this issue. And I'll make sure you get a copy of ours. I did not see a copy of the governor's legal opinion.
Mr. Chair, that's acceptable to me.
Is that all right? Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, on the Scheid amendment or motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations. So far, you got another big hurdle to go, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
But this is a should be a good indicator.
Thank you.
We get 20 members. The next person we're going to hear from is Scott Brenner from the Department of Labor and Industry.
Just go back and
Mr. Brenner, welcome to the committee. And
that we did back in 03.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, thanks. Thanks for having me in today. I'm going to keep this at pretty casual level. Most of your members know me to some degree. The department, I had an opportunity last week to conduct an overview presentation, so I hope with that, members at the table at least feel relatively comfortable with how we conduct business and what business we do conduct. I guess as slight on a more personal note, from a background perspective, if I start twitching, it's because I have twins. They're 2 years old and a five-year-old. They were up last night from 2:30 onward. Finally, I got them back in at 5:30. So I was up, so I went for a 10K, and now my muscles are all tight. As a background, I'm from the East Coast. Some of you may be able to tell, from the state of Tennessee originally. Moved to this state back in 1993 following law school. I was undergraduate at Georgetown University and did my law degree at the Emory School of Law down in Atlanta. I've worked now 14 sessions in some capacity with this legislature. I served under Governor Carlson in a variety of capacities, served as his general counsel and an assistant commissioner to the department I now head up, Department of Labor and Industry. I also served in the governor's office for several years with Carlson as a policy advisor to him in the areas of economic development, labor, IT, telecommunications, as well as some other issue areas. I then did some corporate work for the former Quest, the U.S. West Corporation, ran several divisions for those guys, and have also ran my own law practice. In this capacity, I was brought in by the governor May 1st of 2003, so I've served almost 4 years as the commissioner. I also do some work outside of the confines of my department. I serve on the governor's healthcare cabinet. I serve on Gopal Khanna's Office of Enterprise Technology Board. I was part of the Drive to Excellence group, so I still do work there. I serve on the Military and Veterans Subcabinet. I was also past president of the National Association of Labor Secretaries, and they've been foolish enough to ask me to go back in as their president next year. So I've done a lot of stuff at the national level as well as within state government. Funny enough, one of my former clients you just heard, Twin Cities Rise, so it was good to reconnect with those folks. I did them on a almost pro bono fee structure, but they were an up-and-coming organization with some value associated with them. So it's good to see them doing well. So that's me, a little bit about me. I think, again, you know.
Yeah, Mr. Brenner was in, though, it was last Wednesday, and he gave a presentation, too, about your office. And
so I'm going to be fine. Dangerous here and open this up to conversation and see if there's anything you'd like to talk about.
maybe you're better off standing up and walking out the back.
Yeah, right. Thought about that too.
Just do this. And any questions of Mr. Brenner? Who wants to make this motion? Senator Bach?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, there's a couple different interest groups that have inquired of me if the department is going to propose any rules over your term relative to changes in the state's apprenticeship programs.
Okay. Brenner, you
have the one. Quick question, Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, the quick question to that as it stands today is no. As Senator Bach well knows, we've engaged in conversation on this one. There was a controversial rule regarding apprenticeship and prevailing wage levels as they apply to apprentices last year that the department, frankly, on my judgment, was pushing forward. This has been a frustrating issue, as I've discussed before, I believe, Senator. I think all interested parties in that debate shared, to some degree, a similar outcome. My outcome was I was trying to expand apprenticeship, and that meant expanding apprenticeship on the merit shop side, too. This had an effect of, I won't go long-winded, but it aggravated some parties. I have since pulled that rule, and I've talked to those interested individuals, and we're trying to work through other policy ideas to, in a unified manner, to expand the reach of apprenticeship, which I am a firm believer in.
Okay, so they believe that's the correct
this
answer
point,
as far as...
Unless there's something we can agree to, there's not going to be any additional movement with that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm satisfied with the answer.
That's the answer I wanted to hear, too. Is that enough of a good answer for you to make the motion to confirm this?
I'd be happy to make the motion. Okay.
Senator Bach moves that. Excuse me. Senator Michelle.
Reference to our earlier conversation about whether this is a confirmation or a reappointment. Brenner's been confirmed and he's served well. I want to see him do it again. But,
all right, you're.
We'll be discussing more of the legalities further down the road.
I just want to see the gentleman appointed. That's,
Mr. Chairman.
End of the day, that's what we're after, Senator Michelle. It's not.
I agree.
Senator Scheid, did you have a.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask. Senator Scoy and I were looking at these notice of appointments from the governor, and it does show a term expiration date. I have a feeling that the original one from 4 years ago probably showed a 2007 expiration date. Right. So, I mean, it is somewhat indicative of what somebody thought at that time.
Yeah.
Just an observation, but... I understand the significance of the.
Yeah, well, we'll keep looking at that, but I think, we have our opinions. I think we're right on this one. But anyway, Senator Bach moves that the committee recommend that the appointment of Scott Brenner, Department of Labor and Industry, be confirmed. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations. The next confirmation we'll be talking about this afternoon will be Mr. Dan McElroy, Department of Employment and Economic Development. Mr. McElroy, welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's an honor to be before you today for the consideration of confirmation. I have been involved in these issues for quite some time. When I was a member of the legislature, I chaired the House Committee on Jobs and Economic Development and Finance. I took a great interest in the issues that come before the Department of Employment and Economic Development and participated in the debate over whether or not to merge the former Department of Employment Security and the Department of Trade and Economic Development. I had an opportunity to visit with former Senator Jerry Janicich the other day, and we recalled the conference committee in
which
you
say that was an honor? What you had the honor to meet with? Just kidding.
I said
he's
I had the
good...
honor to serve, Mr.
Chairman. Oh, to serve. Okay.
And it was a great education.
Mr. Chairman. He's a great American, good guy.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But we recalled having crafted the bill by which the two departments were merged, having revisited it several times, created a task force. And I observed that one should be careful when drafting legislation for what one wishes for. One may have to run it someday. That department has existed now for 3.5 years and has brought together the programs that deal with Minnesota's workforce and the programs that deal with economic development. And the assumption was that the economic development issue of the future will be the quality of our workforce. And I think that the assumption was the correct one. And I'm honored to have the pleasure of leading a group of now some 1,550 really great people that work with partners across the state. Very few of our programs are done alone. The 47 workforce centers are partnerships with local workforce investment boards, with not-for-profit service providers, with educational institutions. The workforce training programs we do are often done in partnership. The local economic development, regional economic development boards often bring projects to us that we can help with to help jobs in Minnesota. When I was at the Department of Finance, or many of my colleagues in agencies around state government deal with challenges or problems. At economic development, we often deal with opportunities, and it is an honor to have the chance to do that. You have a copy of my resume and a copy of history. I had a two-track life. I had a day job in which we earned our living running and growing travel agency companies, and then later a company that wrote software and did management consulting for agencies in the U.S. and Canada. In 1980, I was appointed to the Charter Commission in Murrinsville, and then later ran for and served on the city council and was mayor, came to the legislature in 1995. And then when Governor Plenty was elected, he asked me to serve as Commissioner of Finance. I was chief of staff for 20 months, 3 days, 6 hours, and 21 minutes. Not that it was at all stressful. And then had the great opportunity to serve as a senior advisor on innovation for 15 months and to work with a great team of people that have been working to make state government more efficient and more productive. And it was an honor to often serve as their spokesperson while 500 state employees did all the work. And it was, I'm now honored to have this appointment. Let me anticipate one question that Senator Bach may ask. You'll see on my statement of economic interest a company called McElroy Consulting, Inc. It is inactive. It exists to get paid for a business we sold at the end of 2002 because my tax accountant tells me if a subchapter S corporation is getting paid, it has to continue to exist. And so other than that, it doesn't have any active business, nor do I intend it to. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Can we ask them about some of your stocks that you own? Any questions of Commissioner McElroy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the software at the Campaign Finance Board has a way of duplicating some of those. GE and General Electric are the same thing.
And 3M, 3M twice is probably
yeah,
the same thing.
Same thing. I only own a handful of shares in either of those. I wish it were more, Mr. Chairman.
Just having fun a little bit. Any questions, Mr. Chair? Carlson? Mr. Carlson?
I'm concerned about the drop in personal income in the state and some of the things that we have done recently that have not been investing in people, investing in workforce, investing in our higher education. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, I certainly share the concern about the trend, for example, in tuition at our higher education institutions, particularly as it applies to two-year institutions. Our four-year institutions, both at MinSCU and the University of Minnesota, are about at the national average and have excellent results, higher standards. Our two-year schools have the second or third highest tuition in the country, and that's a problem. And we work to drive down administrative costs to put more dollars in the classroom. In terms of the work that our department does to educate incumbent workers, we have some of the most effective programs in the country, and we get good results. We put a great many of the people who are in our dislocated workers program, for example, back to work at relatively high wage rates, at high replacement rates. We can continue to do better. We had a meeting this morning of the Job Skills Partnership Board and talk about better ways to make those results accountable. I'm not familiar with a report that shows our personal income has declined. It's perhaps after adjustment for inflation. I think we have the seventh highest household personal income in the country and certainly the highest in our region. But one of the goals of our organization, we think that there will be a shortage in our workforce, and our interest is not in attracting any job but attracting good jobs and attracting jobs that have the capacity to increase the standard of living for Minnesota citizens. And so as we look to move companies to, or to attract companies to Minnesota, to encourage companies to expand in Minnesota, we're not interested in minimum wage or near minimum wage opportunities. We're interested in good paying jobs. And we target jobs that pay substantially more than the minimum wage, and we'll continue to do that and continue to work with partners to improve the quality of our workforce.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner McElroy, so what do you think about the increase in tuition that we've had? For instance, the number, I guess, is 53% in the past 5 years.
McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, even though our tuition has gone up fairly dramatically, it continues to be a good value in comparison to most of our competitors. Some of our two-year schools are an exception, and I think we need to work to hold down two-year tuition. For example, 6 years ago, we were at the middle of the Big Ten, sixth out of 11th. We continue to be at the middle of the Big Ten. Our Minscu tuitions continue to be at or near the average for the states that we see as competitors. The difference between the tuition of a high school graduate and a four-year or two-year graduate or a four-year college graduate continues to get greater. And so I think the issue is, are Minnesota education's a good value for the money? And are we making the right decisions about things like the state grant program or the state loan program or work-study program so we make higher education as affordable as possible? If you look at the cost of a two-year degree in Minnesota, the tuition at our two-year community college is about $4,000 a year. The Hope scholarship or the Hope federal tax credit is about $1,500. Our state grant and Pell Grant programs assist families with family incomes below about $60,000 for a family of four. We also have work-study programs available. I think it continues to be a good value for the money. But the Minscu board, for example, has passed a resolution saying tuition shouldn't increase by more than 4%, regardless of what the legislative appropriation is. We need to continue to fight to hold down tuition. And I think I'm very hopeful. I know that's the governor's position. I believe the legislature will likely agree with that.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Carlson. McElroy. What I'm hearing, though, is you're satisfied with being middle of the pack in tuitions. Where do you think we really should be? Should we be one of the lowest? In fact, I think we have some of the highest rates of high school graduation. We have some of the highest rates of post-secondary degrees and also higher education degrees. And that's what our businesses are based on. Do you think we should be satisfied with middle of the pack?
Mr. Chairman, I think we should be more concerned with results and with the value for the dollar and having really good graduates that are very employable, that are in the right disciplines, so that we increase the percentage of our graduates who are, for example, in STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, and manufacturing. As you may know, we have four centers of excellence in the Minscu system, which are geared toward emerging industries in high-tech manufacturing, computer security and information technology security and healthcare. I don't know that we need to be the least expensive. We need to be the best value. And we continue to be quite successful in attracting jobs to Minnesota. We've added about 65,000 jobs in the last 13 months. We're growing jobs here faster than the national average after, very honestly, lagging the national average for a few years. Part of that is based on very great success at exports, of manufactured exports, not raw materials. So I think we should concentrate not necessarily just on the price but on the value, and both our graduates and our employers continue to find value.
Carlson. Mr. Thomas. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I noticed in the governor's budget there was a pretty substantial increase in the appropriation to the Minnesota Investment Fund. I don't serve on the budget division of this committee, so maybe this is my opportunity to ask. I appreciate the fact that we're putting some additional money in there. Are there any proposed changes in the program?
Senator McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, I don't believe so, not that I recall. The program continues to have some options between being revolving loans that can be at lower interest or negotiated interest and having some grant opportunities. A portion of the loan continues to go back to the local economic development entity that granted it up to $100,000. We try to use loans as opposed to grants whenever that's a practical approach. We've asked for $7 million for that program, $2 million for the redevelopment grant program, and $1 million for urban initiatives. And as you indicate, $10 million is a significant investment in that program.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, to whatever role that you and other members in the department played to increase that appropriation, you know, having carried that budget bill once, I understand what a good program that is, and I appreciate that.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bach.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McElroy, the glaring thing that's not in here is that there's no money for the 21st Century Minerals Fund, and I know you know what kind of projects we have and what kind of potential we have on the Iron Range for that fund and for the need for that fund. So while I don't want you to comment just now, I want you to realize that we will need to work together and figure out how to get an appropriation for that fund, because we have some very, very large projects on the Iron Range, that, and we need to send a very good message to the financial community that the state's willing to back some of these projects through something like that. And since we loaned the money back to the state to pay for the deficit, it would make sense to me to kind of get it back here now. So at any rate, that I know you have to take the governor's side on this and can't make a comment right now, so I won't ask you to. And their loans. Yeah, and they are loans, so the companies will pay them back. So that's a big part of it. But, Mr. Chairman, if there's no further questions, since I'm going to have to work closely with Mr. McElroy, I'll be willing to move.
Good.
Senator Tomasoni moves that the committee recommends that the appointment of Dan McElroy as a commissioner be confirmed. Further discussion? And then all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator.
The committee meets Thursday?
Wednesday.
What time? 12:30 on Wednesday again. And then the other confirmations and appointments to committee that this standing committee is responsible for will be heard next week. We've got instructions, and I agree that we should get these things out of the way and keep moving. So we did enough today, but we'll do more next week. Committee's adjourned.